Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today I talked to Randall and Ellery, coordinator of the Guelph Wellington Task Force for the Elimination of Poverty. It's a busy time of year with lots of presents and treats to buy, but it's also important to remember that there are many people in our community who are less fortunate, and that doesn't change whether it's Christmas or not. While food banks and other charities work to address the symptoms, the task force works politically to eliminate the disease. So that's the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast, dealing with the politics of poverty. But first, my usual public service announcement. Guelph Politico is crowdfunded through Patreon, where you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card, and all that money goes to maintaining a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you'll be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of City Council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. And now on with the show. When we think of how society addresses poverty, we often think of the little things we do every day to help people with immediate need. We give food to the food bank so that people can be fed. We offer welfare to those without work so that they can pay their bills. We offer shelter to those who don't have a home. In the book of Matthew, Jesus said, "You will always have the poor among you," and when our solution to the problem is to keep putting a new band-aid on the problem rather than giving people a way to get out of poverty, it's no wonder that that line is as true today as it was at the beginning of the first millennium. The Guelph and Wellington Task Force for the Elimination of Poverty is trying to change that, though. They're not the ones chasing donations, but rather they're the ones trying to address the causes of poverty in the first place. Better jobs, higher wages, and low-cost housing is how they're going to do it. The goal of the task force, in their own words, is to work collaboratively, informed by diverse voices of experience, to take local action and advocate for system and policy changes to address the root causes of poverty. That means working with local government, like they have the last year with the 20,000 Homes program, and encouraging local businesses to commit to the Living Wage campaign. It's important, difficult work, and the effects of it aren't always immediately seen, so one has to be very dedicated to the cause. So on this week's Guelph Politicast, I talked to Randall and Ellery about the task force's own dedication, the big pressures on people living in poverty in Guelph, and the three biggest issues that face the local poor, which are affordable housing, living wage, and Guelph's low unemployment rate and how it might sometimes hide a lot of underemployment. Now, not to be a downer on Christmas week, but there are a lot of important issues here that needed to be discussed, and if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, you should consider helping to raise awareness about issues of poverty in Guelph. That's a suggestion from me and not from the task. Anyway, I caught up with Randall and Ellery a few weeks ago in studio. So, Randall and Ellery, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, to begin with, could you talk a bit about the Guelph and Wellington Task Force for the Elimination of Poverty? It's quite a mouthful, but I mean, your scope is wide-reaching, so it's apropos that the long name.
Sure, yes, it is quite a mouthful, and so we often shorten it down even further to Poverty Task Force and even down to PTF. So the Poverty Task Force started in 2009 in response to a community forum on poverty that was hosted then by the United Way. There was an opportunity to hear from other communities in terms of how they were working collaboratively to look at poverty issues and to come up with innovative solutions. And so there really was a groundswell of support to do something locally. So we have been around since 2009. We have a shared vision of eliminating poverty in Guelph, Wellington, and we don't take that eliminating word lightly. There is lots of discussion between reduction and elimination. We work in a collaborative way to focus, primarily we focus on system and policy change that address the root causes of poverty and supporting local action as well. And so we have four priority issues that we focus on: income inequality, affordable affordable housing and homelessness, health inequities, and food insecurity. And so often it's sometimes easier to say what we don't do. And that's that we don't offer programs. We don't run programs. We don't offer service. We don't provide anything directly to individuals. What we do is work with community stakeholders on that system and policy part of our work. And we try to be really strategic about anytime we take on an issue, does this address the root cause of poverty, recognizing that there are incredible programs and services in our community that help people meet their immediate needs in a more of a charitable model, which we have huge respect for, and many of those program and service providers are part of the work we do, but the niche of what we do is the system and policy change.
It's advocacy and policy. It's directed at governments and kind of the people who can enact change, not so much as you know, collecting, you know, the food like food banks do.
Or, absolutely. You know. Yep, got it.
So 2009, probably an interesting time just to get into poverty elimination because, I mean, that was the Great Recession. But I think we're not almost 10 years on, but, you know, it's getting on to 10 years since that. I think a lot of people feel like the storm is over. We have weathered the storm, and there's a lot of talk about Guelph's low unemployment rate, things like that, and, you know, we'll get to that. But there's real genuine pressures out there, and it almost feels like we're in a time where that has become invisible, or maybe it's gone back to being invisible. It was slightly more visible when it was in the news every day, but in the current climate, it's there are a lot of people really still suffering out there.
Absolutely. And I would even say, you know, during the recession in 2009 and sort of following the impact over the next couple of years, you know, we do a lot of work with other communities in Ontario of having that collective voice. And comparatively, you know, Guelph made out all right. I mean, when you look at the impact it had in cities like Hamilton, we did okay. And sometimes part of our challenge, even, you know, ongoing, is convincing people in our community that poverty is a problem. It isn't as visible as it is in some larger cities, and definitely not as visible if you're not visiting the downtown core every day. We do have, you know, one of the lowest unemployment rates, and we are a strong, giving, prosperous community, but there are definitely people struggling in our community as well. And that struggle and what poverty looks like really is on a continuum, right? And so we have people that are definitely the most vulnerable in our community that we see sleeping on the streets, all the way to people that are working full-time, low-wage jobs that are struggling to make ends meet. And so the visibility of what poverty looks like is different depending on what part of the continuum you're looking at. But definitely one of the areas that we have tried to focus on is just increasing awareness about what poverty looks like in our community and the impacts that it has.
I think that's maybe the biggest difficulty in working with these issues is that poverty looks different in every circumstances. You can have a car but still be poor. You can you know, have a home but still be poor, and you can have a TV and still be poor. And the face of poverty isn't just the guy sitting in ragged clothes on the street corner with his hat out.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of the big pressures on people right now, and this may lead into more specific issues that the task force is dealing with right now, but in terms of what are people feeling, you know, in terms of how they're being affected, what are the big pressures that are keeping people poor right now?
I would say one of the biggest challenges that our community has for people that are struggling to make ends meet is housing. You know, having the lowest unemployment rate means that people want to move to our community, which, you know, our vacancy rate is one of the lowest in Canada. It's often the lowest, lower than Toronto and cities like Vancouver. So people come here, they have a really hard time finding a place to live. The rents are quite high in our community as well. And what people receive from social assistance, what they're paid at their low-wage job, doesn't change just because housing is hard to find here. And right. So it's extremely difficult to think about getting food, getting a job, all of those things, those daily responsibilities and survivals, if you don't have a place to call home at the end of the day. And so I think in our community, the really unique struggle and challenge that we have facing us is that supply of affordable and appropriate housing for people.
And it also establishes, or rather sets a curve for what is affordable. And I know you've been following this along, the city developing affordable housing strategy. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what the city is trying to say is this is what affordable housing should look like. I think your group is saying that is not affordable.
Yes. So, it gets tricky. It gets kind of political.
Yeah.
in terms of, you know, what is affordable housing and how are we defining that? The city of Guelph has been developing an affordable housing strategy. They're definitely looking at a different end of the continuum mm-hmm. than, say, the County of Wellington, who's the social service provider. So really looking more at the social housing, rent geared to income, homelessness, that end of the housing continuum. And so, you know, the city isn't wrong in saying that the definition of affordable housing is spending less than 30% of your income. I think it's definitely, if you're someone living in poverty, that is hard to swallow to hear that, you know, an affordable apartment is close to $1,000.
Right.
If you're on social assistance and your shelter allowance is somewhere around $400, it's tough to hear that that's what's considered affordable, but it's important to think about affordable housing as 30% of your income. It does serve a certain part of the population, and it does create a trickle-down effect, which opens up other opportunities, other units for people that can't reach that measure of affordability.
Right, and I think the tricky part too is, and having sat in on some of these consultations with the public, is a lot of there's kind of no in between definition. There's the affordable housing definition, which says that, you know, all things being equal, this is what an affordable apartment or house should be. And then on the other side, there is social housing that is paid for by the government, meant to help people who are really desperately in need. But there's nowhere in the middle where, if you have a, you know, a 40-hour a week job at, you know, a fast food place or a big box store, where you're working full time and theoretically should be able to afford a place, you know, there's kind of nowhere in the middle for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's nowhere in the middle. Absolutely, you're right. There's also not supply of either of those options, right? And so I think anyone that is can't meet that affordable benchmark is just struggling in our community, and those struggles can look different depending on, again, on where you are on the continuum. But you're right, there's nothing in between, but there's also not supply of what we think of as affordable and what we think of as social, too.
And this just occurred to me too, but we just had the tax, the budget passed last night at council. And this isn't about the budget specifically, but the immediate reaction, because of course taxes have gone up, you know, a couple of percentage points, the immediate reaction is, well, now I'm paying more out of pocket. There seems to be a lot of anger at the city for taxes going up. There doesn't seem to be a lot of anger at the assessment authority for raising the assessments on properties, or anger at Toronto residents who are looking for, you know, bigger houses, bigger yards, and, you know, kind of forcing a raise in prices either. That, you know, it's the anger always seems one directed to the source that is actually trying to help level the playing field, no matter what you may think of the city's results on that account. But This is a societal problem. This isn't just government failing. This is a problem of the greater society failing people who need.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with housing specifically, it's so complicated in terms of even when you look at government and what level of government is responsible for what aspects. I mean, it's complicated at a local level, understanding the differences between what the city and county are responsible for.
Right.
You layer in the province, the federal government. It's tough. And there's the, you know, even with the affordable housing strategy around what's considered affordable. And then we're also looking at, you know, the planning side of things and how that all fits into it. So, you know, I really believe that when people know better, they do better. But I think it's so complicated that, you know, again, people's sort of anger and frustration can get directed at the wrong source. And, you know, I think also when you want to make change, you know, it often is it's complicated and it's political and it can be hard to navigate all of that.
And sometimes we just accept any change as good change. And I'm thinking specifically of the 75 Dublin Street North development, where it was being sold on the basis of there's going to be 20 affordable units for seniors. But your organization said, well, this probably isn't going to help very much.
So our poverty task force is actually 100% in support of the development at 75 Dublin as five floors.
Mm-hmm.
20 units, sort of not a huge dent, of course, but absolutely would make an impact. Again, it's that trickle-down effect where we get 20 seniors in there, we suddenly have 20 units that are open up in the community for others that need them. Not to say that it couldn't be filled with other seniors, because they absolutely need affordable housing as well.
Sure.
So we're disappointed in that decision. I know it sort of fell outside the typical decision-making and there were some pressures, but I think that all levels of government need to sort of look at the tools that they can use to make change. And sometimes we have to use those tools outside of the typical processes and protocols.
But there was some concern, right, because of the 20-year provision that, you know, perhaps as, you know, these other affordable units become available in 20 years, they're not affordable units anymore because it's on prime real estate in the downtown that could probably get a better market value.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we do also have other units that have federal operating budgets that are in the county, and we're actually seeing those agreements come to an end over, we've had a couple of them come to the end in the last couple of years and a couple more happening. What we're finding is that the owners are more than willing to continue with an agreement and having those stay affordable because they are still generating a revenue for them. And so I know that that's a concern. We can't sort of say one way or the other if that's going to happen. But I think based on what we've seen with some existing agreements coming to an end, that, you know, it could work out okay too. It might be worth the risk.
Do the incentives work? I mean, speaking from your side of things, when these developments come forward, And people are looking at affordable housing, they're talking to council about, well, how do we develop the incentives for developers to want to build this or these units? Do the incentives work from your point of view? Like, does incentivizing?
I mean, I think we've seen in other communities that incentives do work. And I've definitely sat in on sessions with developers and heard their side of things, and they're definitely looking for incentives as well. And so it does work. I'm happy to see that the city has sort of shifted from an affordable housing reserve fund to more of an incentive-based model. I think there's promising practices there. It does require the city to invest in putting money aside to make those incentives possible.
Well, the flip side of this is people, people's wages and making money, because you have to, even affordable units, you have to, you know, be able to afford them. And to get back to, you know, how Guelph has very low unemployment, I think what is always missing from that conversation is, and perhaps a lot of employment numbers, is to what degree is that underemployment? How many jobs do we have where people are in working in positions where they are not, well, first of all, not being paid a living wage, which we'll get to, but second of all, perhaps the position is not commensurate with their skills.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever that stat comes out from Statistics Canada that Guelph has one of the lowest unemployment rates, people get really excited about that. I think it's great. You're right, though. We don't know what kind of jobs we're talking about, and we don't have a good sense of how precarious they are, if they're a good match for people's skills, if people are commuting in for those jobs. So, that number tells us very, very little. I think right. It's still something for our community to be proud of, absolutely, but I think it's always important to dig a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, I mean, because the job market is kind of complicated now, and mm-hmm. I think anyone who's, had to apply for work or has gone out looking for work lately can certainly attest to that. But it doesn't seem like the statistics kind of keep up with where the market is. I mean, perhaps at one time you could just hear that unemployment is at 5%, and then and that sort of gave a pretty good indicator of what kind of jobs and whether people were being well paid and whether there was true full employment or what have you. But it seems to me that the statistics don't represent the employment market now, where you have people maybe working two part-time jobs or one part-time job or are doing like a contract work, freelance work. In terms of, perhaps I'm not by any means suggesting you should take it upon yourself to explain to me how that we should improve the employment numbers, but in terms of your point of view, in terms of what the numbers tell us, what should they be telling us when we hear this, like, just to give an example, like a 5% number?
Yeah, so there's two things. I mean, numbers don't tell the whole story, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's really difficult to get good statistics for smaller places, especially as we're coming out of a couple of years in the absence of a long-form census.
Right.
What that creates is a need for organizations like ourselves to do the research and gain a better understanding of the impact. And that is one area that we're doing some work on now. So over the past few years, we have been talking about the importance of a living wage and the impacts that being working poor have. But it's always better when we can tell that story based on the impacts it's having locally. And so next year we'll be launching a survey specifically that looks at people that are working poor and the impacts that it has on their health and their well-being. Mm. So we've seen that research done in other parts of the province. And so we'll be able to talk more about really what's happening here in Guelph. And, does having two part-time jobs and sometimes even more to make ends meet, I mean, what is that doing to your overall health and specific health conditions, but also your well-being in terms of your stress and your ability to sleep and all of those pieces as well, which I think will only strengthen our sort of advocacy efforts for the need for things like a living wage and a basic income guarantee.
I want to talk about the living wage in a sec, but mm-hmm. In terms of a survey like that, how difficult is that to get a complete picture? Because we know that people, because of, shame, there's often shame that comes along with being poor. Just the difficulty in getting people to respond to surveys as well. But in terms of, in a non-scientific way, because I know you're not going to be crunching the numbers on this, but in terms of what the survey can provide, how accurate of a picture is that going to present, do you think?
Yeah, so research and evaluation is actually a pretty major component of the work that we do, and we have a really strong research committee of policy analysts and data analysts from different organizations in our community. It's probably one of our strongest groups that we have. And so I know that the survey that we provide and past research we've done has always been good quality, and we're thinking about things like sample size. And so we're not just handing out a survey to, you know, a group of people as they pass by on the street. We're really intentional about ensuring that our research is valid. In terms of getting people to respond, we have also put in a lot of work over the years in building relationships with people with lived experience and involving them in the work that we do. And so they have been huge supports in any research that we do of people with lived experience that can, we've done some training with them around research. So there are community researchers that can deliver, administer surveys, talk to people about the research, and they have connections that I don't, and can get in places that I can't. And we're hugely thankful for the work that they give to us, and that's we couldn't do without them. Absolutely.
In terms of the living wage, mm-hmm. I think this is something we've all heard, it's not a magic number. It depends on a number of different measurements. So could you talk about where the number for living wage comes from? What the number is, like, it's 16 something now, right?
$16.50 an hour. We last calculated it in 2015, and we've committed to doing it every 2 years. So we'll do it again next fall. The calculation process is developed by an economist at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Every community that calculates the living wage uses the same calculator, and it's verified by the CCPA. And so it's a really specific process so that it allows us to, talk about it with confidence and also compare in other communities as well. And so in every community, the living wage is based on a family of four. So the assumption is two parents working full time, as well as two children, one in school age and one in childcare, and the expenses that come with that family. And so we're talking about a pretty bare bones budget, basic needs like shelter, like food. But also, there is an agreement that if you have two people in a family that are working full time, you should be able to afford a decent quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so it does include things like pizza day for the kids, a 2 week family vacation. Mm-hmm. Again, we're not talking about 2 weeks at Disneyland. We're talking about 2 weeks at Guelph Lake.
Just 2 weeks off.
Yeah. But I mean, anyone that has kids knows that, birthday parties and all those little things that pop up. And so it does its best to cover those expenses. It doesn't cover things like debt payments, which, if you've gone to post-secondary or you have any kind of debt, is part of your budget as well. But so again, based on that calculation, we're talking $16.50 an hour for each parent, working full time.
And that's far from a reality, because the minimum wage is 11 something now. So it's $5 off, and I imagine it's only going to go up when the reassessment comes next year.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I think the living wage has two really great things going for it. One is an opportunity to talk to employers about paying their employees a living wage and the benefits of paying their staff and the return that they'll get, which is that employees are going to feel more engaged in their workplace. They're going to be healthier. They're going to show up. You're going to have retention. You don't have to pay for training. All of those parts that are good for an employer. So that's one conversation. The other conversation is the impact that policy can have on what someone needs to take home. And so when you say that when we recalculate it next year, it'll probably go up, We're not sure because this past year, the federal government introduced a new child benefit that is more directed at low-income individuals, and that has that will be included in the calculation. So we may actually see it stay the same or even go down slightly. And I think that's not a bad thing. I mean, we want to put pressure on our government as well to introduce good policy that support people. And this is an example that they've done it. I mean, it is a once in a generation policy that has lifted a huge number of families out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And we should celebrate that rather than saying, oh, shoot, now our living wage is going to go down.
Yeah. I only say it's go up because anything only ever goes up.
But yeah, it may. Yeah. I don't know.
But you make a good point, though, that there is an economic argument for this because anecdotally, there have been examples of places that pay people the working wage. They see the higher retention. They see people more dedicated to their jobs, putting in, you know, more of an effort, because if you're getting a good pay or you're getting good benefits, you obviously want to keep that job. There is an economic incentive. There's an economic incentive into doing this, but we often don't hear about it. I mean, and not just in terms of how people work, but in terms of the keeping people. Because if I work a stock at a big box store and I want to take a week off to do whatever. You know, you don't often get people who give notice because they can go pick up another job at a big box store. Or even something like you were talking about illness. You know, if you're not making a lot of money, chances are a greater chance of being ill. Or if you're working too much, you can't really take the time to recover. And that has an effect on an employer's bottom line, too. Not to, to phrase all human activity as what it means to an employer or a business person, but there are incentives there for the people who pay people and not just the people getting paid.
Yeah, absolutely. We first calculated our living wage in 2013. And so the first couple of years, we just used it as an opportunity to have some community conversations about the cost of living in our community. We knew that we wanted to introduce an employer recognition program. But the people around the table having that conversation were all social service providers and health providers that were looking at, you know, the impact that it could have on their clients who are working at these places. It wasn't until we were able to engage employers and business in that conversation that we slowly started with an employer recognition program. So we introduced that program in 2015. We had 11 early adopters who were all kind of like friends of the Poverty Task Force, right? Like we had relationships. They were doing good work. And we were really proud of them stepping up. But now what's happened is they're out there talking about the benefits it's had to them. So it becomes an employer-to-employer conversation. And then, so this year when we had our recognition program, we had 11 more businesses that signed on. And since that event, which was the first week of November, we've had 10 more come out to us. So, you know, having an employer be able to speak the language of this is what it's done for me, has attracted other employers, and the conversation that the PTF can promote is this is the impact it has on the employee, right? And and it takes both of those for that program to be successful.
Perhaps to you know, we're kind of reaching the end of our time, but we don't seem to talk about this a lot, or it doesn't seem to come up a lot, even during election times. Poverty isn't an issue, and maybe a couple of people or a couple of candidates will bring it up, but I mean, it doesn't sink in the way that talking about jobs does, or the way that talking about the economy does, or even something like electoral reform or climate change. It always seems to end up on the bottom of the priority list. Why don't we talk about poverty enough, and what can we do to change that?
Yeah, I think that the Poverty Task Force early on recognized that people aren't talking about it. Just even at our members committee, I mean, we have all three levels of government represented at that table. They talk about how, you know, our MP and MPP will say, you know, barely anyone comes into our constituency office to talk about poverty, right? And so it is an important topic to so many people. I think the PTF has really focused on elections as an opportunity to raise the profile of the different issues. I think in some places, we've been successful in making it an election issue. I'd say in the last municipal election that affordable housing was definitely a hot topic of conversation. Why isn't it something we talk about more? To me, poverty is the solution is system and policy change. It absolutely is. I think people feel people want to see tangible results. They want to feel good about it, and that often happens through a charitable model, right? So, you can go and volunteer at the food bank. You can offer food to the food bank. You feel good about it. You see the direct impact it's having on one of your community members. It's tangible. It's real. You can touch it. But that's good and that's needed. And I don't want to discount all of that amazing work that happens. To make food insecurity not a problem, we need to have higher social assistance rates. We need to have a basic income guarantee. We need to make sure that people are making a living wage. How do we make sure those things happen? We advocate, right, to our politicians. It's just not as sexy and as tangible and as, feel good as giving that, donating to the food bank or volunteering somewhere. Both are important. I think convincing people that we need to advocate to our politicians and engage them is harder work.
Yeah, you leave a toy at the firehouse, you know that a kid's going to open that toy and be happy on Christmas morning, or you go and sit at city council for a couple hours. That could be years in the making before you see a result. Yeah. It's very true. It's a long-term commitment. If anyone out there is, it's that time of year where people are thinking about giving back. So if anyone's listening to this, wanting to help out with the task force in some way or want to get involved, what are your recommendations?
Yeah, so we have a website, gwpoverty.ca. You can check that out, and all our member organizations are listed. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of them are providing direct programs and services in our community. And you can go to our website and see who those places are. They all are in need all year round, but particularly this time of the year, looking for help.
Well, on that note, Randall and Ellery, thank you for coming in and talking poverty. It's an important issue, especially, well, all year round. But, since the time is right, this is probably the time of year to shed some light on it. So thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, that was Randall and Ellery, coordinator of the Guelph and Wellington Task Force for the Elimination of Poverty. You can learn more about the task force at gwpoverty.ca. And that's all for the Guelph Politicast this week. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, donate to the Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And thank you to everyone who has donated so far this year. And hopefully next year, that's not a high pressure sales tactic, just hopeful. Anyway, for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.